Evidence Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this July the 9th on the West Coast, now July the 10th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. We'd like to also welcome those listening in tonight on Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world, as well as on blogtalkradio.com. Well, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on, and those of you who have been following this show for any amount of time know that we deal with a lot of topics that you don't hear on the mainstream, and we're not bragging. We're rather proud of that, because what you hear on the mainstream is just nothing but mind control. I wanted to see today what CNN and some of the other major networks were reporting on the Gulf situation. I think we've just about exhausted it. Once you identify a false flag event, the next thing you got to do is go after the people that created it and quit paying so much attention to the event. But in this case, there are a lot of animals and aquatic life that's being destroyed, and of course the capacity or the ability to earn a living amongst those that depend on fishing and all the things that go on along the Gulf Coast. CNN was showing Philippe Cousteau and one of their female anchors diving into the murky waters of the Gulf of Mexico. Now, I didn't catch exactly where they were, but I found it rather interesting that they had an underwater cameraman with them, and they dove in with scuba gear, and they had full suits on. At least they had enough sense to do that. And they were showing this grayish blue. You really couldn't call it blue water. It wasn't green and it wasn't blue. Certainly wasn't turquoise or what you see. The water in the Gulf of Mexico, when it's clean, can be just gorgeous, especially if you're into diving anywhere along the Florida coast, and or if you've even seen some documentary film where they show the coral reefs and all the aquatic life. What I saw reminded me, it was almost like somebody jumped into a bottle of Pine Sol, a human-sized bottle of Pine Sol, maybe a little bit lighter color than that. And they were talking and they were saying, look, you can't see anything. Look at this red stuff here. This has to be Corexit here. And the water itself on the surface had the sheen of oil. Now, I don't know. Other than to bring you the news and let you know how filthy the Gulf of Mexico has become, how polluted it has become, I don't know why someone would want to risk their health and their safety for that very reason, unless they were far, far away from the real damage. But I can tell you one thing, just a couple of feet from the surface of the water, wherever they were in the Gulf, the water was so dark that you could barely see them. It was like the first images we had of the wellhead in black and white. What they told us was the wellhead. You have 5,000 feet down, nearly a mile down at the bottom of the ocean. There's no natural light that reaches that far. And yet they're showing us images of this this well blowout that they're still calling a spill. It's just so ridiculous what's going on. Of course, they're not solving the problem. We've looked at the spec sheets, the data sheets on Nalco's Corexit. Nalco is owned, jointly owned by BP and Exxon. And the amounts of toxic substances that have been taken from water samples are hundreds of times the safe level for the fish alone. The fish are dying. In fact, you should, in a shot, in a live shot of somebody swimming in the Gulf of Mexico, you should see some kind of fish swimming around. There was nothing, absolutely nothing. We should be disgusted about what's going on, and I wish people would use their voice and find a way to express their anger and their disgust. We have to put a stop to this. We have to put a stop to it because their intention is to make money with this. I pointed that out on a few shows, and it's not going to change until we do something about it. So consider that over the weekend. I'll be talking about that topic and others with next Monday's guest, Dr. Achu Ott, on that very topic. Also, a quick reminder, next Friday, I have a special guest from Argentina. Mr. Adrian Salbucci is going to be on the show. And then the following Friday, he will be on again with none other than tonight's guest, who is a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, our resident science advisor here on Evident Footprints, and my good friend and co-host, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Don. I've heard a lot about that gentleman. I look forward to sharing a show with him. From what I hear, he's quite an interesting and well-informed man.
Yes, he is. I think you'll be impressed. If you haven't seen any of his videos or read any of his work, he really, as we say, goes down the rabbit hole. He's got some excellent information, and he and I are pretty much in agreement as to what's going on. So I really look forward to sharing his message with our listening audience and along with you as well. You were gracious enough to give him next Friday, and I want to let the listeners know that you will be on the night before, next Thursday. So that's going to be a new one for you. You don't get to sleep in on Friday morning. But nonetheless, we'll have a good time, and I'm sure you'll enlighten the audience as you usually do. Now, Jim, on past shows, I've basically led you along a path of discussion, and you've thrown in your scientific acumen, your knowledge of physics, your knowledge of electricity, your now knowledge of power systems and the various types of power that there are. And certainly you've talked about your own work, but I thought it would be nice and I think something that you would enjoy as well for our listeners to hear some things about the man. What is it that qualifies to say the things that you say week after week for the past, in another week or so, it's going to be 3 years that you've been on my show. What is the motivation for you to come on this show every week? Let's start with that. I think that will lead us somewhere.
Well, actually, I think there are multiple motivations. First of all, quite honestly, I've led a life that's very different from the average person's existence, in that my passion, or one of them, has been to study everything. And, of course, you really can't study everything, but I gave it my best shot. I mean, I have a lot of areas of interest, as you well know, on that range from, you know, astrophysics all the way down to biology and archaeology and heaven knows what else. And, of course, in doing that over a period of time, which has got to be approaching 50 years, my personal interest and my drive has led me to explore some really unusual, almost obtuse topics. And I would say a very high percentage of these things turn out to have real value. And so when I met you and we talked about, you know, the various things that could be discussed on your show, the first thing that came to my mind was enlightenment and transmission of truth, keeping a high quotient of interest, and just broadening the general consciousness and appreciation that people have for their own existence, because I know that the forces that we're exposed to on a regular basis don't normally allow people the luxury of running around exposing themselves to all these different things. You know, the prime directive seems to be make money, pay bills, and then rest up so you can do it all over again. So it seemed like a great opportunity to broaden people's horizons, and that's primarily why I do it. That I really enjoy discussing some of these things with you. I mean, we even have private conversations, as you well know. So to put that together and then put it on the air just seemed like a natural thing to do.
Yeah, and we've often remarked, boy, I wish this conversation would have been a radio show. Of course, we could ask the NSA for the recordings, and, you know, we could broadcast it, but just to get my little jab in there. You know, the things you're describing, Jim, are pretty much the opposite of most scientists I know. Now, that's not all scientists, but mainstream science doesn't want people to know how science works. They don't want people to know the truth about science, and they certainly don't want to reveal what they don't know. They have a way of doing it on news and TV shows, documentaries. Well, we don't know what causes this, but we're hoping to raise billions of dollars to study it. You know, that's always been the song that they sing. And I know that that makes you want to vomit. You probably are carrying a pack of some antacid or some antacid herb around with you all the time when you hear these people talk like that. Your thoughts on mainstream science's approach to divulging the truth about the sciences?
Well, in order to answer that in an accurate and detailed way, I have to force myself to go back to my childhood years, just temporarily. I have always had this passion, you know, for science and for engineering and stuff like that. Of course, it's matured as I have grown, but it's always been there. And when I was first starting to study stuff, my dad was really tickled, you know, that I had this interest, and he used to feed the fire by buying me books. And he bought me this one book, I believe the title was The Young Scientist. And it was a great book, and it covered all kinds of stuff, you know, from basic electronics right through to relativity and nuclear physics. And, of course, in those days, I was just on fire with that kind of stuff. And I remember so clearly, especially after having digested that book, the feeling I came away with was, what could be a more exciting life than to spend your energies and your time probing God's universe so that you could capture fragments of truth and then use that information to do something exciting for the benefit of your fellow man. And I came away not only from that, from the lessons of that book, but also from my earlier experiences in school, primarily when I went away to boarding school and also in high school where I studied advanced math and physics and stuff like that, somewhat ahead of schedule. My ultimate feeling was, wow, you know, there's nothing more exciting than science and the scientific method. But actually, after college, when I started getting into the industrial scene and rubbing elbows with established engineers and scientists, that's when the disappointment set in. Because the truth of the matter is that with certain exceptions recognized, it's unfortunate that I have to report that there's probably no field, but the possible exception of theology, that is quite as bigoted and quite as prejudicial than are the sciences. New ideas are thoroughly resisted, and you know, anything that flies in the face of accepted theory or accepted practice is really met with not only resistance, but even scorn. And so to go off on your own and become a real rogue scientist or a rogue investigator is a really big challenge. You really are alone when you do that. And so I guess my personality is such that I didn't care whether I was alone or not. I was more interested in chasing after truth than anything else. And I've done that primarily at my own expense. I won't say completely because I have had help over the years. But I've never allowed any wet blankets, regardless of how, you know, how officially applied they may have been to hold me back. And I think that, I'm not trying to blow my own horn, but I really think that that's the way a true lover of truth and science should be. If it weren't for that spirit, we wouldn't have any of the things we have. We'd all be hunched around a fire in a cave someplace, gnawing on bones, you know.
Yeah,
so I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, while you were talking, you brought to mind other aspects of science, maybe somewhat outside of your field of expertise in terms of your vocation, but still I know you know a lot about biology and physiology and geology and all the ologies. and it brought to mind the glaring and the obvious state of how we're lied to in terms of our health, in terms of what nourishes the body, what gives the body a long life. It's as though everything is designed to choke us, to suffocate us, to poison us, to lull us to sleep, or just to totally take over our minds, as if we should be zombies or androids or not even robots, because that's a whole different story there. But in essence, we're being encouraged throughout history, and certainly in these times, to accept anything for the truth, whether it's physics or electricity, power generation, modalities of energy production in terms of, you know, this matrix of oil and all the problems it causes, and how it's really the currency or the medium of exchange, and it's not what we are told it is, and how it's marketed is very dishonest. And anyone that comes against any of these methodologies, and we can go into education, of course, religion, you hit that, or theology, whatever you want to call it. There's this cynical attitude by all those that promote that agenda for the world stage, those that secretly control things in the background. And to me, it's the most obvious example of ignorance of all they profess to hold, or all, you know, all the power that they claim to have is based on what? Illusions and lies. And I bring that up in the context of the spirit of what you're describing about your passion for discovery, discovering things about the universe. And I know that I use the term walk a tightrope. We walk a tightrope between the truth and what is not the truth all the time, because it's gotten to be dangerous to speak the truth. They are that desperate because we have the capacity to see the game that's being played upon mankind and change it. Your thoughts on that, sir?
Wow, that's a mouthful. Well, okay. I think that precipitates, you know, down to the subject of suppression for the most part, because whether they use brainwashing or propaganda or, you know, a very tightly structured educational system, the net objective is to keep you on a predefined track in terms of your thinking, your behavior, the things you're allowed to pursue, and the money that you would need to do all that with is also restricted. So, in a sense, even though you're free to, you have the illusion that you're free to do whatever you want, you don't have to stray too far before you run into walls on each side, and you realize you're actually in a channel that's been constructed to guide you the way somebody else wants you to go. And until you either break through that wall or climb over it or somehow disconnect yourself from somebody else's objective, it's very, very difficult to really make what you might call first magnitude discoveries. And you know what's really interesting too? I mean, even if you just don't even worry about making discoveries, just having friendly exchanges of information, there are very few people that you can do that with who really rise to the occasion and say, oh yeah, I mean, we should be looking at for this or that, or we should be trying to do this, or we should be exploring in another direction. What I have found is that most of the people that have a formal education, and especially those which have the higher degrees, they can't even participate in a hypothetical conversation without getting on a soapbox and telling you, you know, oh, no, that's an error. You can never go that way. You can't do this. You can't do that. And it's almost like, you know, I mean, I try to look at it objectively, and the feelings I get is that it's almost like what's really happening is there's some kind of a resentment there that you are not as programmed as he is, and he wants to make sure that he gets you back on the same track that he's on. And if you resist that, then animosity creeps into the picture, and you don't even get to enjoy an intelligent intellectual exchange. It then becomes an argument based on the way he feels about a particular subject, which may or may not have anything to do with the truth.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very strange set of circumstances.
Well, we know from our studies, our research, and even our conversations that war does not create peace. War creates war. And to imply that it creates anything else is a lie. So when you look at all the scientific applications that have been transformed into weapons, a means of killing people or suppressing people or torturing people or all the sadistic things that are done with those weapons, you see a blatant abuse of scientific principles. When the argument always is, well, you know, we have to be secure, we have to be safe. Where's the safety? Who is safe when one is killing? When one is murdering anywhere on the planet, who is actually safe from that. There is no safety. Least of all, the one doing the murdering, because eventually it's going to, you know, the karmic loop is going to come back upon that individual or those individuals. It's so insane what's going on, and yet the brilliant scientists that work in nuclear physics can't see that, how they've contributed to the demise of, or the potential demise of billions of people on this planet. Or the chemists that create products like the one that they're dumping in the Gulf of Mexico. These people have no conscience. Oh, well, I gotta earn a living. You know, we have to make this stuff when we have oil spills. They call them spills. They lie to us about what they are. And, you know, in other words, these people may be brilliant in one sense, and I see them lacking the quality of having a soul or a heart. There's no connection. There's no high connection to the Creator in these people, that they can so wantonly do the bidding of what they know in some part of them is evil. I don't think science was intended to become the evil weapon of Satan. But in these people, that's all it is. And all these things that we talk about week in and week out are basically the same things over and over again. Different dimensions of the same thing. Trying to show people what's really going on. But if we just stick to that one thought, war cannot bring about peace. It can only bring about war. Well, then the question is, what brings about peace? And that is peace. And with that comes consciousness. War, there's no consciousness required to be in a war. All you have to do is make the weapons and start using them. Wouldn't it be interesting, though, if the first bullet that came out of a gun or a rifle or some weapon that one person fired at another person, wouldn't it be interesting if the first one fired backward at them? And then if they survive, then they're free to shoot anybody else. But the likelihood of that happening, if the gun worked properly, they wouldn't be around. That would put an end to war right there. Give them all guns, let them shoot at each other. They'll kill themselves. That's basically what they're doing anyway. It's just played out to be something other than it is. And most people, they'll believe anything. So,
well, it's interesting you bring it up in the way that you did, because just like you can't achieve peace with war, I mean, you also can't establish wealth on the basis of debt. But, so a lot of the things that we're taught are actually diametrically opposing forces, which are artificially linked together. And I think that, if you're not really conscious of what's going on, once you accept these distorted truths, or whatever you want to call them, these foundational lies, let's call it that.
That's what they are.
That, certain parts of your brain just cease to function properly after that, because normally what happens is if you perceive two opposing concepts, you realize that there's something wrong. But I think that after a while, if you hear it enough times and you accept it, then that entire mechanism becomes numb. And if you hear it enough times, you don't even react to it anymore. You just assume that it's, maybe you don't understand it, but you accept the fact that it's probably true. You know, and I don't have a list in front of me, but I know that there are a lot of situations in the artificially constructed reality that are made up of these opposing concepts, which are presented as some kind of a total truth. I know we've discussed them in the past. I'm just
Yeah.
Right now, I can't think of which, you know, of what they might be. But, I mean, all of that kind of stuff is so indicative of the methods that are used. I guess it does take a special breed of individual to either have the interest and the focus and the consciousness to not be affected by this stuff, or to eventually catch and recognize the procedure that's being used on them, and then make an effort to circumvent that type of mental conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
I think most people just figure it's easier not to bother.
Well, yeah, there's a certain apathy, a certain laziness that comes about, and I'm sure all these things contribute to that laziness and that apathy, and ultimately it results in a level of unconsciousness. And since we're all playing a part in this whole scenario, it's like a big movie, we're affecting that in others. We can affect the awakening of consciousness, or we can be part of the sleeping pill. And I think part of the problem is that there are those that, in a sense, are waking up, or they feel that they know there's something wrong, or they've learned, they've done some research, they've studied, they've read. And the first time they hear somebody that comes out with something that they can sort of attach their hope to, all of a sudden that person becomes a saint. And I'm not speaking of any particular person, but it's when they hear what seems to be or hold a promise of escapement from a situation. Oh, this person here, he's got all the answers. You know, this is going to resolve the whole thing. Well, you have those people listening, and then they're really not paying attention to how this information is coming about, or from, you know, what the source is necessarily. It's as simple as, you know, if I came on this show and I said, well, you know, I've been working in the oil fields for 30 years. All of a sudden I'm an expert because I made that statement. Whether it's true or not, you see, that's the point I'm making, is that people are just ready to jump on any old bandwagon if it's the one leaving town. Or the one that lets them stay in town and keep on partying and pretend like nothing's wrong. This quest for the truth and this quest for consciousness is a serious one, and it requires a lot of devotion. I wonder if you would share with the audience your personal awakening, if you can recall that time. Maybe you've already answered that in just describing, you know, how you got into science, but and then how you nurtured that is what I'm getting at. What propelled you to take this path, and how have you nurtured it all these years?
Well, that's a long story in itself, but as far as an awakening is concerned, I mean, I don't really know that it was an awakening so much as maybe it was my rebellious nature just refused to go sleep. I mean, I came here awake, just like everybody else does. I just refused to be lulled into, you know, a form of catatonic behavior. You know, when I saw things, I saw them for what they really were, and you know, I ran into all kinds of situations, even when I was really young and I wasn't so much pursuing the science as I was just, you know, interested in adventure and stuff like that. The things I did, you know, taught me that there's really two realities interwoven, simultaneously interwoven, into the fabric of this world. And you can kind of jump from one reality to the other if you're conscious of both of them, or you can decide, you know, to reside in one or the other. But in order to do that, you have to be conscious of the fact that there's two. And I just instinctively rejected a lot of stuff that was thrown at me.
Mm-hmm.
And it left me in a very interesting situation where I was forced to say to myself, well, okay, if I really want to go down this road, I'm not going to have any help. And so I have this internal truth meter, or whatever you want to call it. It's just an instinctive feeling. And, you know, I would ask myself questions. You know, do you think this is possible? You know, what are my feelings about this or that? And in the beginning, it was very difficult, because if you try to research things that are not in the common knowledge pool, you don't really have too many choices. You can try to find an individual who's a truly free thinker and ask the opinion from him, or you can attempt to find something written in text that at least sheds light on what you're interested in. Well, the third thing that you can do is to follow your instincts, you know, faithfully, and just go ahead and test it out. Become an experimentalist and find out, you know, directly whether what you've envisioned is correct or not. And that's the path I chose primarily. I mean, everybody does all three to some extent, but I concentrated primarily on just testing the ideas for myself. And the interesting thing is that having made that decision forced me also to become proficient at so many different things, because if I didn't have those supporting proficiencies, I couldn't be an experimentalist. And to give you an example of what I mean by that, you know, when I was about 12 years old, maybe a little older, maybe I was 14, I'm not sure anymore, I began learning, you know, how to make models on the lathe, and then I progressed to milling machines and shapers and welding and all this kind of stuff, because I needed to know how to make things. And then when you want to do that accurately, you also have to be able to do drafting and make engineering drawings. And you have to be able to do calculations and make projections, you know, with mathematical assistance and mathematical modeling. And to control the things you make, you need electronics and feedback circuits and eventually automation and all these things. So once I decided that that was the direction I wanted to take my life, then I very greedily absorbed as much information as I could about everything that I imagined would be required to lend assistance to the course I had chosen. And eventually that even led into finance and funding methods and patenting and corporate law, you know, all different kinds of things. So I guess you could say that I just, after I made the initial decision, you know, to investigate things on my own, I tried to become a real Renaissance individual and acquire as many of the skills as I would need to do it completely on my own. Of course, later I realized that it's even better to have a team composed of like-minded individuals. But when I was still pretty young, my concept was somewhat more limited, and I just imagined doing it all myself. So that was what I prepared for.
Well, as you were describing that, I recalled something you said a little earlier in the show, where you said there are these two realities that are existing simultaneously. And I suppose really we could do several shows on that. We already have even. But it dawned on me. Well, you said, well, a person could decide to be in one or the other or in both of them. Now, are we saying one is a reality of illusion? And that's already a paradox in and of itself. But in term, isn't there the possibility that, and I think that really that's the state of the earth, is that we're told that we're in this, maybe the second reality, but in reality, we're in the first. We're imprisoned by the first and not conscious of it. In other words, a person could be unconsciously in a different reality. One might argue that that could lead to insanity, but tell me this reality that they have now, this in this quest for a new world order, tell me there's anything sane about it, if you get my meaning. So,
no, I get your meaning completely. As a matter of fact, we did a show on that once where I try to point out that the world that you accept, let's use an example of a kid growing up in New York City, for instance. You know, he could spend the majority of his life there between school and work and, you know, eventually marrying and having a family of his own and never leave the city. And under those conditions, that totally artificial environment becomes his reality. And, you know, yet that's a very small piece of real estate, you know, when you consider the total surface area of the planet. But for that particular individual, that could be the whole world. And if you took that guy and dropped him in the Amazon rainforest, I think he'd have a very strange awakening to the fact that there's a world outside the one that he knew. And what I was trying to get to there is that, you know, over the centuries, the people who have been guiding the fate of this planet have been organizing and constructing a reality for the sheep, or for the slaves, or whatever you want to call the general populace, in their view. And that reality is very, very different from what the Creator originally put here. And I think that, you know, most people, whether they're conscious of it or not, they definitely make little short excursions from the artificial reality into the real reality. And then they might just pop back in again. And that's what I meant by, you know, existing in a little bit in both.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you've got the people that are totally immersed in the artificial world and don't have any inclination of getting out. And then you have people who just say the heck with the whole business and they walk away and attempt to reside in the natural world. And I guess I could say that in many ways I have attempted to do that. You know, I challenged myself by going and living in the wilderness for 7 years and, you know, going to South America and exploring all kinds of places, you know, where I didn't have to be, but I wanted to find out the difference. I wanted to understand the contrast. And it's a very awakening type of experience to do stuff like this, you know. And there's a very big difference between loading the station wagon with all the garbage you can stick in there and going to a, you know, a public camping ground for the weekend and then coming home and saying, wow, that was an amazing experience. Well, it might be for the individual that's totally immersed in the artificial world, but to completely disconnect and go live on your own, let's say, up in the Canadian wilderness somewhere for a couple of years where you don't even necessarily see another person, that's a whole different ballgame, you know, and so those are the kind of things that really awaken parts of you which are pretty much asleep. And I think that the idea of going through life with your higher sensory organs in a perpetual state of slumber is really what allows people to become so susceptible to mind control. Because if they weren't, if they realized the difference, I think that they would be able to resist it, or at least see that it was an artificial course that's being forced upon them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I agree. In fact, from time to time, some of my guests on their own radio shows are interviewing people who are part of these mind control programs. And we're not talking about one's ability to discern the truth when they hear the news. We're talking about the fragmenting of the personalities and creating multiple personalities and enduring torture through various means, whether it's electric shock or waterboarding or drugs or enduring violent beatings or forced to witness the murder of a child, things, you know, just the most obscene, evil things you can imagine to cause this person's psyche to fracture into various compartmented and named identities that are then restructured and used for sinister purposes. There's that level of mind control, you know, that comes out of the MK Ultra mind control program, the stuff used by the military and the intelligence agencies on unknowing people, starting with children. Many times with the infants, they begin this. And that person's reality is such their whole life. And people just can't get a grasp on that because they don't even see how they're being mind controlled through the media and through certain types of technology that are there. Not there, you know, no one's going to come up and tap you on the shoulder and say, hey, you're being brainwashed right now. Pay attention. It's all very subtle when it's in terms of the masses, but to somebody who's awake, they see it right away. They see the method right there.
That was my whole point in bringing that up, because you had asked me what steps I took to pursue the things that I tried to do in my life, and how did I proceed. And I wouldn't have been able to have the revelations and the little episodes of grains of truth making themselves apparent if it wasn't for the fact that, you know, I was always partially outside the box to begin with. The other thing is that even when you're shown something of an extraordinary nature, if you don't have the proper foundation to recognize what it is, it just goes right on by. And that's a consciousness thing. So, I mean, it's not really a simple thing to answer. I mean, I think that the totality of your life experience comes into play no matter how you want to investigate whatever you do. And the things that have brought you to the place where you are have to be considered when you try to make sense out of the whole thing. You know, if somebody is well educated in the traditional sense and you show them something that flies right in the face of everything that they've been taught and have accepted, let's say, for the past 30 or 35 years or whatever, their mind will not accept it. It's not just a simple case of a denial. The brain shuts down because you're back to that situation where you have two opposing forces and the mind can't go in both directions at the same time, so it just draws a blank. Or the tilt sign lights up, or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that has restricted mankind for so long. And I will go along with what you said earlier, too. It is a subtle mechanism. Like, to give you an example that everybody who's listening can certainly appreciate, the difference between an essay examination and a multiple choice test. You know, when you're given a multiple choice test and you say, you know, the shape of the world is a cube, a sphere, an oblate sphere, you know, A, B, C, you know, and you have to pick one of those. The right answer is there, but also the unfortunate thing is it is subliminally training you that there are only a certain number of possibilities. And it restricts you from ever using a higher form of expression in providing the answer, because you have no way of going beyond checking the box. Whereas if you have the same question presented to you in a test where you can write an essay for the answer, you still wind up saying that the planet is the shape of a spheroid, but you now have this extraordinary latitude to explain everything about that phenomenon and what the exceptions are, what the limitations are, what your personal observations are, and on and on and on. And so even the way that they test you is also a training procedure to restrict your thinking.
Well, not and, only that, but when the teaching is based on methods of propaganda, you're not even offered the truthful answer. If you happen to know, Jim Murray, the answer to that scientific question, and it's not there, what do you do? You see? It's held
blank.
Against
you. Well, know? That's a good question, and that's the reason why. Well, I used to get in trouble for that, because I would just write an essay question at the bottom. I mean, an essay answer type thing at the bottom and say the above choices are not acceptable to me. Of course, you get an F, but at least you get it out of your system.
Yeah. Well, I referenced that that CNN broadcast of the diving expedition into the filthy Gulf. And I heard Philip Couteau, or I should say Cousteau, rather. I said Couteau is a knife in French. Cousteau, Philippe Cousteau, in a perfect American English accent, explained to us that the murkiness of the water was from core exit. You couldn't see anything, but they're telling the people that they're cleaning this up. And they're not telling the truth that this is actually more toxic than oil itself, or the oil and the burning asphalt, what they're putting into the ocean. So that's promoted through the media, and somehow, because the media has always been accepted as the official source of the truth, regardless of what you know in your scientific studies and your scientific research and your inventions, when you hear that, it must anger you to no extent. I used a different term. I said that you carry antacids around with you, or would be inclined to. when you hear that.
Well, actually, what happens in my case is I just shake my head, you know, and let it roll off my back, because it's futile to do anything else, and at least you already know that it's a lie. But more importantly, what are all the hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people who were not in the position to do that, what are they supposed to do? You know, I mean, they, like you say, they're so used to accepting, you know, the outpourings of the media as being truth. But let's take it a step further. Supposing somebody wasn't inclined to believe it. How are they going to test it? You know, in the case of the Gulf situation, you're not even allowed to go near the Gulf. They got private security forces patrolling the beaches. Of course, that should tell you something's wrong right there. But nonetheless, if you had a question regarding anything, there's no way for you to answer it. You know, it's sort of like the essay test that you, I mean, the multiple choice test that you just referenced, that the correct answer is not among the selection. You know, it's the same type of a frustration. And so I think that a lot of people just throw up their hands in bewilderment and say, well, c'est la vie, I'm going to go ahead and do what I do every day. Because there's no other way to proceed.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is that it becomes a way of life, and then it doesn't matter what you're confronted with, you have a tendency to take that attitude. And I think that that's part of the mechanism that's gotten us in this much trouble. Because, you know, if people were more vigilant and more concerned about what the so-called leaders were doing, they would never have been able to get away with half the shenanigans that they have gotten away with. You know, an occasional hanging is a good thing.
Yeah, you know, many of the religious teachings use a two-word phrase, know thyself. Know thyself. What does that mean? Does that mean know what you like or know what you look like or know what your tendencies are, what your desires are? Most people would say wants and needs. But those are negative situations. They are the opposite of who you are. They really have nothing to do with who you are. They don't make you who you are. What I'm getting at is we look at a problem like the world's facing right now. The masses are being told that there's an oil shortage, yet we have this volcano of oil, or the illusion of a volcano of oil spilling into the Gulf of Mexico, and we have chemicals being put in there to handle that situation. The whole problem very likely may just be the chemicals. Let's say that just for sake of argument. And people are trying to cope with, well, why isn't anything being done about this? Or I have to do something about this. And so you have all these different flavors being thrown at the easel like paints, and they're interacting with each other. Now, there are other modalities of producing power through different types of energy sources. I'm sure you would agree with that. And they are liberating. But in another sense, there's this energy, this unseen energy of all this chaotic thought that's going on that's being cast out into the universe and bouncing back in the way it does. You know what I'm talking about there. You know, it's like prayer. When you pray correctly, the universe responds correctly. When you set your intention correctly, the universe responds. And we're all interacting with each other that way, as well as the universe is trying to interact with us, and it's just a cacophony. It's distortion and noise, white noise. Not even the easier to handle pink noise. Do you see that happening? I don't know if I've explained myself clearly enough, but do you see these energies conflicting with each other?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of a similar thing to having a a chamber of some sort that holds a gas, and you want to find out what is the average kinetic energy of these gas molecules as they're bouncing around in there. And, you know, every one of them is going in a different direction. So, I mean, you have a net effect, which is not zero, but it's a very, very low number compared to what you would have, for instance, if you could take the kinetic energy of those same molecules and arrange them somehow that they would all be operating in the same direction.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what the problem is with the world's level of consciousness. You know, everything is so fractured, and there are so many different philosophies and so many different goals, so many different beliefs, so many different cultures, and on and on and on, that the net result is a very low level of achievement. And I think that this is not only known, but I think that it's capitalized upon.
Mm-hmm.
Because if humanity ever really woke up and everybody realized that all the various philosophies, the ideologies, the religions, the cultures, and all the stuff can still be held on to, but it doesn't have to be the primary issue. You know, if you want to pursue those things or believe in those things, it's fine. But the direction that mankind should be going into as a group or as an entire species on a planet, you know, should be a well-organized, thought-out thrust into the future. And if it were, this place could be a paradise.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the same individuals that are the vampires in the situation who, you know, essentially profit from all of this confusion, they would be left out in the cold. But what's wrong with that?
Yes. I had mentioned to you, and I agree with what you're saying. You're basically evoking a response similar to what I was trying to say. Wouldn't it be interesting? I was reading a couple of weeks ago Plato's Critias, which speaks about Atlantis. And, of course, this is considered to be mythology. Wouldn't it be interesting if all of a sudden we were just to wake up as if somebody threw a switch and we realize everything we've been taught is the mythology? Because, in a sense, Jim, it is, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. That's what we're essentially saying. But, on the other hand, that leads you to a very strange place also, because now you're forced to ask the question, well, there's so many different possibilities to consider, then what is the reality that I can operate in? And I think the interesting answer to that lies in a better understanding between the objective and subjective realities. You know, the objective reality would be whatever the entire majority of the planet decides they want to make this place, and there's a great deal of cooperation and interaction towards a singular goal. But the subjective realities are those things which are unique to us, and they don't have to get in the way with the overall thrust of humanity. There's no reason why they have to get in the way. But for some reason, the pot is stirred in such a way that people can't differentiate between, you know, what they experience internally and what they expect to see externally, and the net result is mass confusion.
Yeah, that's kind of what we were saying before, just a couple of minutes ago. I posed that question, or I don't even remember if I asked the question or made a statement, because I've been doing both. But in the sense of people are looking for solutions. They're looking for answers. And we've said this before. You know, where is that place they could look for the answers? We've always said one can begin by looking within themselves, in their heart, and making that universal connection through the heart. And stepping outside, if you want to go back to your thoughts, your scattered thoughts and your negative, depressing thoughts, you can do that. No one's going to stop you from doing it. But it's when it's imposed upon everyone else that it becomes another control issue. Because those things they're only real to the person that has them. Jim, your thoughts are not my thoughts, and mine aren't yours. We can share our thoughts, and we can see if there's a common plateau where we agree on things. There are many things between us, just like there are those similarities between what we're saying and our listening audience, or they wouldn't be listening to us. But those that are looking for the old ways to solve the problems are basically staying in that same reality, are they not?
Well, sure they are, but it's the old problem. It's the same reason why religion or theology or whatever you want to call it is so fragmented. It has to do with the fact that there's the outer reality is something everybody agrees upon, and the inner reality causes contradictions simply because you can never prove that it's the same as somebody else's. For instance, if you and I go to a supermarket together and we go over to the fruit stand and we pick out an apple, and I hold it up to you and I say, "Don, what color is this?" And you say, "It's red." And I say, "Well, I agree, it's red." So the external stimulus is reporting a red apple, and we both agree on that. But the problem is that subjectively or internally, I can never prove that my concept of red is the same as your concept of red.
That's true.
And when you reverse this problem, it becomes even worse. If you have insights which are totally subjective and you try to externalize them for the benefit of someone else, it's almost an impossible task unless they have had an absolutely similar experience and you've compared notes to the point where you agree on 99.9% of what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And therein lies a great deal of the problem that people actually have, in ascertaining what is their reality. But because there are two different types of reality.
Yeah.
So we kind of come full circle on that.
Well, yeah. Now, that apple could be red on the inside, and we both presume that there would be some off-color white inside of it. But it's quite possible that the inside of the apple is totally brown and rotten. So we have to look at the whole thing. It brings to mind the fact that people ask or expect others to tell them the way things are, and then they're just going to accept it or reject it without taking the path. They want to get to the destination without making the journey. And I think the journey is what is important. If you're making the journey, you have a better chance of reaching the goal or the destination. But certainly, when another is telling you what it is and making rules that you have to follow, that that's the way it is, then your options are quite limited, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And not only that, but there's this really bizarre issue of trust. I mean, if I want to go to a particular place, like, let's say, the Grand Canyon, and I journey there on my own, and I finally get there, I know I'm there, because I went through all the steps to arrive at that destination. But if somebody else says, geez, I'd love to go to the Grand Canyon, but I'm not about to go there, I'm not about to trek there, it's too much of an effort. And then you say to some third party, why don't you take me to the Grand Canyon, you know? I'll wake me up when we get there. Well, I mean, unless you know that person really well, or that agency really well, who's to say where he's going to take you? And that's part of what's wrong with this present situation, because we say to the government, you know, oh, do this for me, you know, and do that for me. And we, in a sense, trust them with aspects of our life and our existence which should never be turned over to another person or another agency. But it's this crazy tendency to take a shortcut or to arrive at some form of destination with no effort. In reality, there's no such thing as that. But the interesting thing is that the tendency or the wishfulness for that exists, and then there are those people who say, well, good, let's capitalize on it. It doesn't matter if it's not real or not. We'll give the illusion that it's real, and people will fall into the they'll just fall into the trap. I mean, that's done regularly, but nobody ever questions it, or at least very few people do.
Yeah, I've talked to people that play bingo, and they'll tell me, well, I won $100 or I won $20. Oh, so you came out ahead? Yeah, I did. Then I ask them the question: how much did you spend on your boards and your, you know, whatever you use to avail yourself of the possibility of getting bingo and winning some money? Well, let's see. Well, there were the tickets. The seat was this much, but by the time you get to it, they spent $100 or more. They don't count what they put out. They're just counting what comes back, as if somehow that was just something that fell from the skies. Or the person.
Yeah,
that
I'm
says,
very familiar with that. As a matter of fact, it's interesting you brought that up. When I was working up in northern Michigan for Bethlehem Steel, we used to take a ferry boat to work because the mine was over on Drummond Island. And it was probably a 20-minute ride by ferry boat, something like that. And then, of course, you know, the boat sits at the dockside for another few minutes, you know, collecting passengers and waiting for the scheduled departure time and all that stuff. So a lot of the guys used to just play poker. And they would play for pocket change, you know. And I got very interested in, I still can't play poker, but I got very interested in what the winnings really amounted to. And there were two guys that played religiously every day, and I would just keep tabs of it. And at the end of the year, nobody won anything. You know, it's a momentary illusion that's based on a slice of reality which is not real. It reminds me of mathematical analysis of a sine wave. You know, a sine wave is a very simple thing to draw, but the interesting thing is it's the formula that represents it is only accurate when the function is limitless or infinite. As soon as you take a slice out of it, you know, to represent a fraction of that function, Now the mathematics to describe that is 1,000 times more complicated than the original thing was, and what you're describing is an illusion to begin with, because it only exists in a very narrow window of time, and it doesn't include all the rest of the function. And we have a tendency to do that a lot in life. You know, we look at an event that is happening at a particular instant, and we somehow come to the conclusion that that's something all like a mini reality unto itself. But mm-hmm. when we, as soon as we do that, we discard the relationship that it has to the rest of the continuum of reality. And so it becomes illusionary. I mean, I see that in engineering a lot too, you know, where you linearize a function, or you traditionally focus on a certain set of potential answers or potential equations because it's the accepted way of doing something. But then when you really understand what's going on, you realize, well, heck, it's not even real. The overall phenomenon is so broad, you know, that most people couldn't contend with it. So an artificial solution, which only represents part of what's really happening, has been selected, you know, to represent the event. We do this all the time. I don't know why, but I know it happens.
Yeah, when what you're speaking of really is moving into a state of multi-dimensional awareness, multi-dimensional consciousness, rather than seeing, you and I described this, I once used the example of a dot on a piece of paper, and that what the dot can see basically is depends on its position, its orientation. And then if you connect a bunch of dots together, now you're describing basically that process, the line from point A to point B. We have been trained to think that way and to react that way, because we are reactive beings in this controlled society. The things that are perpetrated, which we call false flag events now, are designed to cause us to react a certain way with a predicted outcome. Not necessarily an accurate outcome, but, you know, it's a predicted outcome or anticipated outcome. And that's the dilemma mankind is in and has been for a long time. This term that's always thrown out, it's like when I talk to people about Jim Murray on my show and I tell people what you do and they say, oh, he's into free energy. You know, they want to start using terms that really are not truly describing the issues in that sense. And I know that's a sore spot with you in a lot of ways because, in a sense, all energy is free. It's available to the whole of the universe. The particular characteristics of that and what its form that determines how it's used and for what purpose. What is energy if it's not put to use? And you rightfully chide us and remind us that it's in the production of power, doing work or performing some function. Something useful, something that benefits the user. And we are obscenely violating universal laws in that regard. Would you agree?
Well, not only universal laws, but the interesting thing about it is that, you know, some of the people that ramble on about all this stuff have no conception of the true nature of physical law either. And two shows ago, I was trying to describe that very situation and explain the fact that in order to differentiate between such parameters as, let's say, energy, work, force, displacement, power, torque, you know, all these different things, you have to know what they are. And it's not just a question of mumbling off a definition. It's also understanding what they mean mathematically, because if you're going to operate in that realm, that's a requirement. And so when people come out and make statements like, oh, free energy, what the heck is it? I mean, it's an annoying term only because it's a colloquial response that doesn't really tell you anything. You know, I mean, if you read Tesla's work, for instance, where he talks about natural amplification of power, that's a whole different ballgame. Now he's talking about machines that he invented where you put in 10 kilowatts and you get out 1,000. You know, and everybody goes, oh, you can't do that. That's a violation of conservation of energy. But did anybody take the trouble to find out what the man is talking about? You know, the same genius that gave us the 20th century is making a statement. And everybody knows better than he does, you know, because they're willing to make a judgment based on something that somebody else told them. It turns out that all that stuff is incredibly complicated. And it goes to the real heart of the issue, which takes us right back to what we've been discussing tonight. You know, what is reality? Where does it all start? And you know, what does it mean when we interact with it? You know, one of the most extraordinary issues that I love to discuss is the difference between Einsteinian relativity and Tesla's relativity. Because Tesla is all about what happens to a power source when it's moved from one reference frame to another. And that's a whole different thing than what Einstein was talking about, where you have, you know, translational effects that are moving at the speed of light, and how are they regarded by an observer. Well, one is a fascinating and endlessly complicated series of arguments which may or may not have practical application. But in Tesla's case, he was out there doing these things. And it took him a lifetime to understand what it meant. And so I react to it very negatively simply because of the fact that people just squirt out these answers, and it only takes a little bit of probing to realize that they don't know what the heck they're talking about. But they offer the answer of really just the same.
Yes. And well, of course, you see, that justifies their starting a movement where people pay dues to become members of that movement or foundation or a board of directors in the name of that group that basically acts as a data gathering center of those that are on the precipice of bringing a breakthrough in the sciences in that regard to mankind. It allows them to be gatekeepers, or that allows them to be pioneers in the field. But we don't seem to be getting anywhere with that. That in and of itself, I think, points to the fact that you can't get somewhere with something that's not real, you know, or it's not been identified properly. Maybe that's the better way of putting it.
Well, my argument in that exact regard has always been this. If it was truly against the laws of nature, you couldn't make it work, period. So if somebody really and truly has machinery or equipment or electrical circuitry or whatever that behaves outside the accepted brackets of the norm, that may raise a lot of people's eyebrows, but if the thing is actually working, then it can't be against the laws of nature. Because nature already will not allow something to happen which is outside of the capabilities expressed by that law. You know what I mean?
Well, if that begs then the question, if it is within the realm of nature, then what is the responsibility of honoring what is natural? I mean, I don't see birds and plants plotting against each other, creating a nuclear confrontation. Mankind is doing that, or those that rule over mankind are doing that. Mankind in general doesn't want to see nuclear annihilation. It doesn't seem to fit in our best interests. And it seems to, in a sense, challenge nature as if to overpower it or to destroy it. I think, yeah, it might be operating under universal principles, but to me they seem rather anomalous or abnormal. Mutant might be a good word. You get my meaning there?
Yeah, I get your meaning, but I think the answer is very, very simple, and that is that, you know, the laws of nature are in themselves capable of being applied toward any end. I think they're infinitely malleable in many ways. But the people that use their consciousness to direct the laws or to operate them in ways that suit their ends, they are the aspect of the equation which is outside the laws of nature. In other words, you know, anybody that would, for instance, design a hydrogen bomb with the intention of obliterating, you know, X number of people somewhere, the laws of physics aren't going to change just because the intention is negative. The whole universe would collapse if that was the case. Those laws have to prevail. So the bomb will go off. There's no question about that. But the individual who directed the activity is, in a sense, outside the laws of nature. He is, something's wrong with it. Something's wrong with that individual. Morally, spiritually, and every other way. And unfortunately, there's a lot of those characters running around these days.
Yeah. It wouldn't just have to be a nuclear bomb. It could be a false flag oil event in the Gulf of Mexico, too, couldn't it?
Well, of course, it could be anything. I just used the first thing that popped into my head for an example.
Yeah.
It could be anything. It could even be a Federal Reserve note.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the reason I brought that up is because that's what's on everybody's mind right now. And, of course, we're not hearing the truth about it, but the fact is that those that are controlling this situation have stepped outside the laws of nature in the sense of perpetrating this act. There's clear evidence that it was created for financial gain. And, you know, we've talked about that. That's not the issue I want to get into here, other than to say that to defile nature in such a way and to continue to defile it even more while explaining that to the masses that you're actually fixing the situation, which is another lie. It's another illusion. There's got to be unimaginable karmic debt. And, you know, we're out of time here, Jim. I want to give you, if you can respond to what I just said, and give you the opportunity to make a closing comment as well.
Well, I really think a great deal about the accumulating karmic debt, to be honest with you. And there are some aspects of that which people should really think about. Because, you know, the karma can be so large that when payback time comes, an awful lot of innocent people that didn't necessarily have anything to do with the particular crimes against nature wind up being swept into the vortex of karmic retribution simply because it's happening on such a large scale. And that's something that people really need to think about. Because you have these megalomaniacs that are running around the world arranging for all of these events that they feel are in their best interest. In the meantime, nobody's paying any attention to the type of devastation that's being brought against the planet. And that in itself is a form of karma. And if that is suddenly reaches a satiation point where it's time for payback, I guarantee you no force of nature is going to pick out, 150,000 people with halos and put them on the side while everything else gets destroyed. Everybody is going to have to bear the brunt of the retribution, and that's just the way it is. So, it's in our best interest as a species to really accelerate our consciousness and look at what's being done to this world, because there will be a payback. There always is.
Yep, and we may or may not even be around to see it.
the payback could, on the way out.
Yeah, the payback could be that severe that that you wouldn't even be aware of what you were paying back. And this is such a complex issue, but Jim, I appreciate your input and sharing your thoughts on these issues, because the arguments that we're being given are like that bogus multiple choice test that doesn't even have the true answer as one of the choices. That's what we're living in today, I really feel. And to pretend that it's anything other than that is disingenuous. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do, and I think the simple solution is just don't take the test. You can't make a silk purse out of a pig's ear.
That's right. Okay, well, Jim Murray, you're going to be with us next Thursday. So for all the listeners out there, because I've booked Adrian Salbucci on next Friday, Jim Murray will be with us one night earlier. Jim, I look forward to that time. In the meantime, I want to wish you a really wonderful weekend and catch up on your rest. I know you look forward to your weekends. And look forward to seeing here next week.
Very good, Don. I'll be available for you as always.
All right. Folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and tonight's guest, scientist, inventor, Jim Murray. Special thanks to Wind Talkers Radio Network and BlogTalkRadio.com for making Evident Footprints your choice tonight, as well as your loyalty and your trust that we're going to keep bringing you quality programming. I want to thank both Seth Hendrick and Don Newsom on the sound. Don't know which one's at the board right now, but just to cover my bases, also want to thank Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me next Monday evening when my special guest will be Dr. H.U. Watt. In the meantime, I wish everyone a great weekend and have a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.